It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're in the second week of that government shutdown, and now a lot of attention is going to the next big fiscal showdown, raising the debt ceiling.
Yesterday, we talked about the economics of the debt ceiling, and today we're talking about the politics.
Now we want to hear from you, too. What do you think we should do about the debt ceiling? Should Congress raise it or not, and why? Who do you blame for the mess we're in? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can send an email to talk@WPR.org. Mark Goldwine joins us now. He's policy director at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get to the debt ceiling, watching from where you're watching, were you surprised that the shutdown happened?
You know, I was, but Washington never ceases to amaze me. Rather than come to a bipartisan agreement to, you know, fund the government at its current levels, we just shut off the lights and close the doors.
And now it's a double whomper because there's the shutdown and then right away this debt ceiling debate. I want to talk to you about consequences a little. We've heard a lot of dire warnings from a lot of people about the impact of not raising the debt ceiling. Some Republicans this week are saying, you know, it's not really going to be this massive default, not that big a deal. What's your take on the consequences of not raising the debt ceiling?
Well, look, government shutdown is disruptive. Breaching the debt ceiling, I think, would be disastrous. First, we would start defaulting on many of the obligations that we've made, promises to contractors, to Social Security beneficiaries, to Medicare providers, and we put at risk the full faith and credit of the U.S. government.
Leading up to the government shutdown, the debate seemed to be mostly over delaying or somehow changing the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare. With the debt ceiling debate, it's been a little different. It seems like a lot of it is trying to tie the debt ceiling increase to deficit reduction. Do I have that right?
Yeah, this is actually good news because the focus on Obamacare was somewhat of a distraction. The real problem facing this country is an unsustainably growing debt.
And I want to define terms here. There are two words I use sloppily sometimes, I will admit. Debt and deficit. Can you distinguish between the two before we get much further into that?
Yeah, that's a great question. Deficit is how much more we spend than we raise every year. So that's annually what our shortfall is. It's how much new borrowing we do. Debt is the accumulation of all of the borrowing. So you can think of it as debt is the balance on your credit card, and deficit is how much you put on it each month.
And President Obama has been saying, including in his talk yesterday, that he was saying under his administration, the deficit has been going down, meaning the debt is still growing, but more slowly than it had been. Is he right about that?
Well, as we're recovering from the economic crisis, it's true that deficits are falling from their record high levels. But if you look at the long term and even the medium term, we're still on an incredibly unsustainable path.
So should it be, in your view, a top priority for Congress and the president to get that deficit down and start chipping away at the debt?
You know, I think it has to be. Now, that doesn't mean we should reduce the deficit this year. In fact, we've done a lot of deficit reduction for this year, and it may be hurting the economy because it's coming from things like sequestration. But the sensible, logical pro-growth policies, they take time to save money, and they take time to phase in. So we should enact them now and let them start to take effect over the next few years and even over the next few decades.
And that's been part of the debate, hasn't it? There's a more aggressive deficit hawk that wants to cut, and then there's people who say, yes, we can deal with the deficits, but we shouldn't give till it hurts when it comes to deficit fighting.
Well, I think there's that debate, but there's also the short-term versus long-term question. I think most folks agree that over the long term, we really do need deficit reduction. And I think those of us that are sensible think that the best way to enact the deficit reduction is to put it into law today and let it phase in over time.
Well, they've tried that, haven't they, with super committees and other tactics to try to really just have that be in law. Why hasn't that worked?
Well, the parties have been unable to come to agreement. Look, I worked on two commissions that tried to accomplish this, the Simpson-Bowles Fiscal Commission and the Super Committee. And in the Fiscal Commission, we actually were able to have a package that had some really tough medicine. It raised the Social Security retirement age. It changed Medicare in a number of ways. It raised new taxes from tax reform. And we were able to get 5 Democrats, 5 Republicans, and 1 independent, 11 out of 18 supporters in favor of it.
So what's the stumbling block? If you got that much agreement on it, what is it that derailed it and made it not become a reality?
Well, I think this stuff is tough, and everybody is looking for how they can be the one that wins. Look, I think that Democrats realize we're going to have to take a serious look at our entitlement programs. Medicare and Social Security are rising unsustainably. And I think Republicans realize that as the population ages, these programs are going to have to cost more, so we're going to have to get more revenue to pay for them. But they're in this constant battle of, who wins by slightly more. But the truth is, they're all losing.
So budgetary measures, things like spending and tax cuts, as you say, they have political consequences. Is it possible to get politicians who are looking at the next midterm election, the next presidential election, to maybe take that risk, to risk a backlash and make an unpopular cut?
It's tough, but I do think it's possible if they all do it together. There has to be shared sacrifice. Everyone has to hold hands and have each other's back, not beat each other up in the next election over it.
You're looking for deficit reduction, debt reduction in the long run. But what do you think of this idea, this tactic that's come up of tying it specifically to the debt ceiling increase? Is that a good way to approach the problem?
You know, I think that threatening default is a huge mistake. And if we actually did default, that would be disastrous. But I do think the debt ceiling offers us an opportunity, a reminder that we do need to deal with our national debt. And if you look historically, there have been a number of times where raising the debt ceiling and reducing the deficit have gone hand in hand.
What's different now than then? As far as are we just more divided? Is there a bigger partisan divide? Or is there something else going on that makes it so we can't reach those compromises anymore?
You know, I think there's two issues. One is we are incredibly divided, more than maybe any time in modern history. The parties are further apart. But the other issue is the problem's tougher now. I mean, the truth is, we could always count on revenue recovering and spending stabilizing to do most of the work. But now with the aging of the population and growing health care costs, the problem is just harder.
I saw on your website a recommendation, at least from one analyst there, that maybe it's time to try a super committee approach again, give up on the elected officials making those unpopular decisions, try to get a super committee to get a grand bargain of some sort. Does it seem like realistic to think that the parties would get behind that?
Well, we weren't recommending a super committee. We were actually just reporting on a proposal out there that would do so. But it's tough to know the best way this can work. Will it be regular order? Will it happen through the committees? I think the president needs to be involved, frankly, and I think the Speaker of the House needs to be involved. So whatever special process there is, I think it starts with those two men.
Now, I'm guessing probably you're not going to get too heavily into the blame game, but do you see either party or both parties being intransigent, not putting enough on the table in this debt ceiling deficit debate as we head toward October 17th?
Well, you know, when we look back to the shutdown, I think that the fixation on Obamacare and the willingness to shut down the government over it was a huge mistake by the House Republicans. And I think that really cost them and the country. But I think the president talking about not negotiating, I think is also a problem. Look, I understand why the president doesn't want to pay a ransom for the debt ceiling. He shouldn't have to. But the president should be willing to talk, and he should be willing to talk about these important deficit reduction measures that can help grow our economy and get us in a more stable financial path.
The president has referred to the term, the debt ceiling as an unfortunate phrase. He says it creates the impression among the public that this decision alone is increasing our debt, when in fact it's already committed to spending that we're paying with debt. Do you think that debt ceiling is a misleading phrase?
Well, raising the debt ceiling is akin to paying your credit card bill. You've already racked up the debt. Now you need to make good on it. So I don't know what the right way to describe it is, but no one should think that raising the debt ceiling isn't spending the new money. It's paying for the money you've already spent.
There's been a lot of argument about precedent here. Has the debt ceiling become a political bargaining chip just in the last handful of years, or is this something that we've seen again and again over the last, decades or even century?
It's been a bargaining chip in a number of debates over at least the last few decades. But I don't think it's ever gotten as serious than it has in the last few years. I don't think that we've ever been as close to the brink as we were in 2011, for example.
We're talking about the debt ceiling showdown. October 17th is the deadline. Our guest is Mark Goldwine, policy director at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
And what do you think we should do about the debt ceiling? Should Congress raise it or not? And who do you think is to blame for the current stalemate in Washington? Have all these fiscal showdowns affected your view of the government? And if so, how? We'll continue that conversation after the break. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Riggert. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
We'll pick up our conversation now with Mark Goldwine, Policy Director at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. We're talking about the debt ceiling debate.
And we're taking your calls now, too, at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or if you like, you can post instead on the Central Time Facebook page. We're wondering about what you think. Should Congress raise the debt ceiling, and why or why not? And who do you have to blame for the stalemate and the gridlock that we've got going on in Washington right now? And maybe all of this has changed the way you feel about the government. How has it done so? Call us, 1-800-642-1234.
Mark, we've talked some about the possible domestic impact of this possible debt ceiling default coming up. What is the rest of the world watching here? Are they as worried as people in the United States about the outcome of this?
I think they're starting to. For a while, it seemed like this was just a game, because often it is. You know, the government takes us to the brink of shutdown, and in the last minute, they find a solution. They take us to the fiscal cliff, and in the last minute, they find a solution. But I think the markets are starting to get antsy.
And we've been doing this, as you mentioned, for a couple few years now. We keep coming up to these, you know, border of a shutdown, border of a default, and so on. Do you see a future where we aren't doing this every couple few months?
I would hope so. I think the best way for everyone to get out of this for at least a while is to have some type of bigger deal. I don't know what the right sequencing is, but something that funds the government, raises the debt ceiling for a long period of time, deals with parts of this mindless sequester, but also includes some substantial deficit reduction from entitlements and some type of process for comprehensive tax reform.
I want to talk about some of the solutions people have offered if we don't get this debt ceiling increase. One of the arguments from people who say that this wouldn't be that big a deal is, hey, the U.S. government still has some revenue coming in, and we can pick and choose, pay off the most important bits, to pay off the interest on the loans so we don't default, that sort of thing. Do you see that as a viable solution even in the short term?
I'm skeptical even in the short term. I mean, that would involve immediately stopping 33% of our payments, roughly. One slip up, we could be in trouble. You know, if you were the bondholder at a corporation and it stopped paying its obligations, you might be worried that you're coming next. And I think the same thing could happen if the United States government stops paying its Social Security benefits, its contractors, its hospitals.
And last time we were at the edge of the of a debt ceiling issue, our debt rating was downgraded a little bit. Do you see that as a possibility?
I think that if we raise the debt ceiling in time, we're not going to get a downgrade. But if we go past that deadline, I could certainly see that as a possibility. And, you know, the first downgrade doesn't usually hurt that much if we look historically in other countries. But each subsequent downgrade hurts more than the previous one. And it's a black eye, really, on which should be the wealthiest and most powerful government in the world.
So once might be an isolated incident, more is a pattern.
Right.
We'll go to the phones now. We've got Kathleen in Milwaukee on the line. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. You know, you asked a couple questions who I would hold responsible. You know, for the most part, you know, I've watched and read and pretty much understand what's going on. Not really delighted with either party, but more concerned about people not being well-informed to understand what's going on. The Republican Party, back during the George H. Bush administration, talked about starve the beast and has been trying to put the government in a dirty light for a long time. They ran up the deficit during Republican administrations. I believe they bailed out on the presidency and let Obama take over by running weak candidates. And I'm not at all surprised about what's going on. I'm kind of watching it happen. But I'm disappointed that most Americans can be manipulated by the money that goes into the campaign and the TV ads that tell them something that's absolutely not true, and they don't feel the need to research the truth.
All right, Mark, main point there, I think. Americans don't get this, and we're part of the problem.
Look, our leaders have to be accountable to us, but we have to be accountable to our leaders. If we're not telling them what we want, if we don't understand what the tough choices are, it makes everything more difficult.
One argument last time we had a call in on this is that we heard from some callers is, look, we've got to run the government like a household. You can't just keep raising your debt ceiling if you're a household. Or the other analogy is a business. Is that a reasonable kind of analogy to use when we're talking about a government budget?
Well, look, households and businesses borrow all the time. They have mortgages. They have equipment loans. Some amount of borrowing for an economy that's continuing to grow is not only sustainable, but it can actually be helpful in a number of ways. The problem is when your borrowing gets out of control. You know, if you're always borrowing a little, but your income is always going up, you're okay. But if your debt is rising as a share of your income and you have no way to pay it back, you're in trouble.
We'll go back to the phones. Now we have James with us in Milwaukee. Hi, James. And James, can you turn your radio off there? You there, James?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, what did you want to say?
Well, I mean, you were asking about who is it to blame here, and as a black man down in Milwaukee, I mean, let's face it, this is just pure racism against a black president, okay? It's the white Republicans in Congress that don't like the black man being in charge, and all they're doing is just giving, you know, the president a hard time. Now, if this was a white Republican or a white president, okay, that would be different, you know? But obviously, this is just pure blatant racism all the time. Anytime a white person speaks against a black person, it's racism.
All right. Thanks for the call, James. Do you, I don't know, Mark, do you buy that? I mean, Democrats and Republicans are having debates like this regardless of the race of the president. What do you think?
Look, I think these problems are so structural that we have a political system that is in so many ways broken, and electoral system with gerrymandered districts that I think feeds into that brokenness. And I think we need to get beyond that partisanship if we're going to solve everything else.
All right, so let's start looking ahead. Let's say there is an 11th hour agreement to raise the debt ceiling. I won't even try to speculate on what the exact terms of that would be, because that's probably that argument is changing by the hour. But say we do that. What would you like to see as the roadmap forward over the next 6 months or so in public policy?
Yeah, well, look, it's getting to the point that it's probably too late for us to include in this short-term debt ceiling increase the types of cuts and reforms that we really need. But what we can do is raise the debt ceiling for a short period of time and agree that we're actually going to sit down. That would be such an accomplishment if both parties just sat down and talked to each other, set a target, and then work towards it. And that's going to require making our entitlements sustainable for future generations. It's going to require reforming our tax code. And by the way, there's $1.3 trillion in annual tax breaks. If we cut out a lot of that money, we could both reduce rates dramatically and still have money left over to help reduce our deficit.
That's on the revenue side, getting rid of some of those tax breaks. Where do you see some of the likeliest cuts in spending?
On the spending side, we got to get Medicare under control. The truth is we've already cut probably too deep into defense and into some non-defense programs through this mindless sequestration. But our Medicare program is continuing to grow rapidly and unsustainably. We have to fix the incentives so providers are being rewarded based on quality of care, not quantity of care, and so that beneficiaries have some skin in the game at first dollar. And we can do that in a way that also gives them new protections against the risks of medical bankruptcy.
Well, I'm going to open a big bag of worms with not much time left. The hope for the Affordable Care Act is that it was going to do some of what you said. The fear of the Affordable Care Act is that it was going to do the opposite. Where do you see that affecting our deficit and our long-term debt?
No matter how good or how bad the Affordable Care Act is, it was never going to solve or break all of Medicare's problems. So even if we set that issue aside for a little while, we have plenty of other things to be worrying about, and we should be.
All right. Do you see the political will there to do some of the things you're talking about? Do you have any sense of optimism at all as you look ahead?
I do if they all do it together. This is going to require people to accept things they don't like, to accept things that are politically not popular. And the only way it works is if Republicans and Democrats join hands and agree to do it together.
So that doesn't sound that likely, does it?
Don't count them out yet. I mean, I wouldn't call myself an optimist at this point.
All right.
But I think we have an opportunity.
Okay. Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Mark Goldwine. He's policy director at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. You can keep this conversation going, by the way, on the Central Time Facebook page. That's Central Time on WPR. Head over there, share your thoughts on this mess, the budget mess, the politicians, where you could see spending cuts or revenue increases. That's Central Time on WPR over on Facebook.
Coming up next, we'll hear about the 50th anniversary of JFK's visit to northern Wisconsin as part of his 11-state conservation tour. We'll get some stories in that and hear about the kiss that JFK bestowed upon a certain citizen there in northern Wisconsin.
And then after that, the prostate monologues. Our guest had prostate cancer. He talks about his experiences and why we're so squeamish about talking about prostate issues. Stick around. Some more great conversations coming up here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. President Kennedy was known for his international policies in Berlin, the Cuban Missile Crisis, but just 2 months before his assassination, he made an 11-state conservation tour.
Danielle Kading of WRNC in Ashland has part one of our series on the 50th anniversary of JFK's trip that included a stop in northern Wisconsin.
The Ashland High School band played just as it did a half century ago on September 24th, 1963. About 200 people turned out to celebrate last month, not the same size as 50 years ago when roughly 12,000 crowded into the city airport to catch a glimpse of President Kennedy. Perhaps no one was as close as 5-year-old Diane Tetzner of Washburn.
President Kennedy kissed me on the forehead. And I remember on the ride home with my mom and my grandma telling them that President Kennedy kissed my forehead and I was never, ever going to wash my forehead again.
Her husband, Greg, didn't have it so easy.
All I remember that we came to this farm right here because there was so much traffic on the road and my family walked through the field to see the doings over there.
Stan Bebo recalls lots of smiles and excitement. Then a young Ashland police officer, he remembers the crowd crushing against a snow fence, steel posts bending forward as they strained to see Kennedy.
The crowd was very, very excited. When he got off the helicopter and walked up to the podium, the crowd just roared.
Kennedy spoke for just 8 minutes after flying over Lake Superior.
Lake Superior, the Apostle Islands, the Bad River area are all unique. They are worth improving for the benefit of sportsmen and tourists. In an area of congestion and pollution, man-made noise and dirt, Lake Superior has a beauty that millions can enjoy.
We don't remember those fights today.
50 years later, former Wisconsin Congressman Dave Obie told the crowd at what is now JFK Memorial Airport that the president's visit brought national attention to the crown jewel of Lake Superior.
I'm convinced that until Kennedy's visit, there was very little awareness in this area of the drive to set aside those islands in perpetuity for generations.
In 1963, the Apostle Islands were still 7 years from being preserved as a national lakeshore. Obie says that wouldn't have happened if not for Kennedy and the persistence of Wisconsin U.S. Senator Gaylord Nelson. His daughter Tia Nelson agrees.
And that was a long, difficult journey, but day in and day out, month in and month out, year in and year out for 7 years, they simply kept at it with the conviction that if they did so, that they would prevail because it was a good and right idea.
So began the idea that conservation and economic growth can go hand in hand, says Bob Krummenacker. Krummenacker is the superintendent of the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore.
So 50 years ago, President Kennedy was here. 50 years from now, who knows what it's going to be like. But I think we, the Park Service, will still be here. I think we will still have the opportunity to be stewards for this very cool place, improving the economy in northern Wisconsin, and doing something that's really important for the American people.
The forest, the Gulf Stream waters, This land was made for you and me. This land was made for you and me.
For Wisconsin Public Radio News, I'm Danielle Kading in Ashland.
Tomorrow, in part two of a series, we'll learn how Kennedy set the stage for grassroots environmental protection efforts to grow into national conservation policies.
This is Central Time. Prostate cancer is the second most common cancer in men and the second most fatal. Our next guest was diagnosed with prostate cancer. He had surgery, decided it was time to address the issue head on, answer questions, and give other men advice on how to weather cancer without losing your sense of humor. Jack McCallum is a sports writer and journalist. He's the author of The Prostate Monologues, What Every Man Can Learn from My Humbling, Confusing, and Sometimes Comical Battle with Prostate Cancer. Jack, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Sometimes comical. Now, the word cancer and comical don't usually appear side by side. Why is it important to keep a sense of humor about this?
Well, I think prostate's one of those diseases that, first of all, it's, you know, invariably mispronounced as prostrate.
Yeah.
Somebody always has prostate cancer. It involves the ramifications of treatment involve, sometimes incontinence, which is a whole other, you know, sense of humor, shopping for pads. It involves many times, a great majority of times, erectile dysfunction. That's always a, you know, great source of humor. And the only thing I thought that I could bring to this, I'm not a medical doctor. I thought just approaching it from the standpoint of kind of the lighter side of it while reminding everybody, yes, as you said with your statistics, this is a very serious illness, but it is one that can be dealt with, I think, with a sense of humor.
Well, for those reasons you just mentioned, do you get a sense that we as a society and men as individuals are kind of squeamish about talking about it in the first place?
I think that's probably true, although what I found is that, I guess, and I'd say fortunately to this, as men age, and it is a disease that comes upon you when you're a little bit older, as men age, my experience was they are much more willing to talk about it, because I think what happens anyway is when we get to the age of 50 or 55, half of men's conversations will be how many times they get up to pee during the night. And that becomes sort of like the jokey intro kind of to prostate cancer, which is, by the way, not necessarily a symptom, although it can be. So I think men, as they get into their 50s, get into their 60s, are probably more willing to address things like incontinence and erectile dysfunction, which, God knows, I would not have been addressing them when I was in my mid-30s, I can tell you that.
Well, let's hear your story. How did you find out you had prostate cancer? What was the process?
Well, I think one of the reasons I felt that I could write the book was I was an incredibly typical case. I was 62 years old, typical age to find out. I found out with a rising PSA from a standard test that my primary care physician ordered. My PSA was 3.8, which is not amazingly high. However, it had grown exponentially from my previous test, so there was a velocity factor, which was what they call. He suggested getting a prostate biopsy, which brings understandable terror to a man. But nevertheless, I did it. I did it kind of seamlessly. I actually went to sleep. And when I was done, I just had the feeling that I did not have prostate cancer. It just didn't. I didn't have symptoms. The doctor told me during the biopsy that my prostate, from all he could see, was, quote, normal. Not that you usually see cancer, but mine did not seem enlarged. But when the biopsy came back, I in fact had a measurable amount of cancer. And once again, I was the typical case. I had the amount of cancer, which, you know, you could have a debate on whether or not it had to be treated or whether or not it could be, the recommendation would be something called active surveillance, which is watching the cancer monitoring, taking PSAs, getting another biopsy once a year to see how fast it's growing, because along with being a very fatal cancer in a large number of cases, prostate cancer is also the kind of cancer that many, many, many men survive. And in fact, the statistics say that everybody biopsied above the age of 85 would probably have prostate cancer, but did not necessarily die from it.
And that's one of the weird things about this disease. And a lot of your book is concerned with talking to experts and people who have been through this on that tough decision. Do you aggressively pursue it and get the surgery, or do you actively surveil? What were some of the opinions you heard back and forth there?
Well, that is the essence of prostate cancer. I mean, if you hear you have pancreatic cancer, you have to start planning, you know, the rest of your life, because statistically, you do not have much of a chance of surviving that beyond 18 months. Lung cancer is a very, very, very difficult disease also that kills a lot of men, and percentage-wise, between those who get it and those who die, kills more people than prostate cancer. The adjective that associated with prostate cancer, as you indicated, is perplexing, is confusion. What do I do with it? And I talked to expert after expert after expert, and if I was going to say if I talked to 30 people, medical experts, doctors, not guys on the street, 15 would say, would look at my cancer and would have said, well, I think you should have done active surveillance. I think you could have watched this thing. I don't think you were going to die from it. You didn't have to risk incontinence and ED. The other 15 would say, you did absolutely the right thing. This needed to be treated. This was not a negligible amount of cancer. No, you were not going to die when you're 63 or 64. You may not have died when you were 75, but how do you know you weren't going to die from it when you were 80 and you were best to get it treated now? So it's the kind of disease that causes a lot of confusion, and there is not a consensus. There's not a clear consensus in cases like mine of what to do, and that is the perplexing thing about it.
And as you mentioned, what you did was you got the surgery. What persuaded you to go that way?
Well, number one, I went to Johns Hopkins and presented myself as the perfect case, I thought, for active surveillance. It was a small amount of cancer. I had done some research. My wife probably did more than I did. That seems to be typical, that as soon as you have cancer, you know, the man will watch a Law and Order rerun and his wife or girlfriend will begin, you know, Googling things about it. And I went down to Johns Hopkins feeling they would tell me that's kind of the temple of active surveillance. Mm-hmm. Well, Jack, you're a great candidate for active surveillance. Don't worry about this thing. But I was considered, strangely enough, the younger you are and the in better health you are,
okay,
the more argument there is for getting treatment, because if there's nothing else wrong with you, the greater likelihood is you are going to die of prostate cancer. And obviously, the younger you are, the more chance you are, the more years you're giving yourself to be overtaken by it. So my first thought was that. Then it just weighed on my mind. I'm not the kind of person to write down my PSA and go every 6 months and turn my life into someone as someone with cancer. Because when you have cancer, it sort of overwhelms everything else. And I just didn't want to be that guy who had cancer. And finally, I got enough opinions that I just thought that robotic surgery, which is, you know, more non-invasive than traditional surgery, it's done laparoscopically. I did some investigation about my surgeons, and I just finally felt comfortable about getting this done, and damn the repercussions.
We're talking to Jack McCallum. He's not just a guy who had prostate cancer. He's a sports writer and journalist as well. His new book is The Prostate Monologues, What Every Man Can Learn from My Humbling, Confusing, and Sometimes Comical Battle with Prostate Cancer.
Well, we'd love to hear from you on this. Have you had prostate cancer, and how do you deal with the conflicting advice and all the emotional stuff that goes along with it? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Riggert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up again with Jack McCallum. He's a sports writer, a journalist, and author of The Prostate Monologues. We're talking about his experience with prostate cancer, and he's hoping to get other people talking about it, too. And you can talk about it at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Share your experiences if you've been diagnosed with prostate cancer. Jack, before we get to the phones, one big debate, to screen or not to screen, as it seems like as big an argument over whether or not you get the surgery.
It's a huge argument, and it came along right, you know, after I had gotten diagnosed that something, a government, I don't want to call it a government task force because it sort of distances itself from the federal government. My contention is it's about as close to a government statement about prostate cancer as there is. But their recommendation is not even to get screened for prostate cancer. The reason being, according to them, that the ramifications of overtreatment, that is getting treatment when you shouldn't have, therefore, you know, erectile dysfunction, biopsy problems, incontinence problems, problems with surgery, outweigh statistically the benefits of getting treated for prostate cancer. Now, they certainly have, I'm not a medical doctor, and, you know, to summarize this quickly is very difficult, but I concede, my concession in that was, there's a difference between, you know, getting over-tested and getting over-treated. I think every man should know everything he can about his health, and if I had prostate cancer, I want to know if I had it. Whether or not is I get treated is maybe where the debate comes in, where you should talk to your doctors. You want to look at the statistics about how long you're going to live. You want to look at the numbers across the population. That's fine. You know, you should do that. But I think the idea of not getting screened personally is ridiculous.
Well, we've got a lot of people who want to talk about this. Let's go to Wayne in Milwaukee. Wayne, hi.
Hello.
What do you...
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yep. What's your story, Wayne?
Yeah, I'm 75 years old. I had laparoscopic surgery going on 5 years. It'll be 5 years the end of this year. I was in the hospital for one night, and I walked out the next day and continued my life except for the running. I couldn't run for a while. I've had a zero PSA reading ever since. And at the end of this year, if I still have a zero PSA reading, I'm sure I will, I'll be able to donate blood that I had been doing for 30 to 35 years. And that was very important to me.
All right, but, Wayne, thanks a lot for the call. So a happy outcome from surgery there, Jack. Did you hear a lot of stories like that?
I did. And, you know, my story is very similar to Wayne. I was a lot younger. But surgically, they do amazing things with prostate cancer. You know, I had the robotic treatment. I was the same thing as Wayne. I would add, you walk out of the hospital with a catheter
right.
for 8 days. But, you know, that was it. And part of what I say in the book is that this idea, you know, I felt almost guilty sometimes. I'd go to the grocery store and people would have known I had cancer. And they'd kind of look at me and go, well, how are you, Jack? Are you okay? And they'd kind of look for signs of dissolution from me. You can recover quite well from this surgery, and I'm glad to hear Wayne has, and I certainly have myself.
All right, Wayne, thanks a lot for calling. We'll go now to Will in Madison. Will, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Yes, I also am a survivor. I had surgery at age 45. I'm 53 now, and probably am in better condition than I was before the surgery, but I'm also calling, I'm a white man, and I became aware through friends that prostate cancer is so much higher. The cancer rate's 25% higher in the African-American community, and with many cancers, that's also the issue for African-American men. So there truly is a major difference, too, in what's going on across race when it comes to prostate cancer that needs to be known and a part of factored into when folks start getting PSA tests and so forth at a younger rate than we white men.
All right.
And I think that's part of this mix, too, that needs to be out there and in the conversation. I'm very grateful for this, and I hope to read the book, The Prostate Monologues, by the way.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Will. Jack, is that something you ran across?
Absolutely true. And in fact, the organization that recommends against PSA screening, which is the United States Preventive Services Task Force, the USPSTF, you can Google to get the whole story with it. They actually, in their sort of mediation against PSA screening, they mentioned, one of the number one risk factors is being an African American. So they don't exactly say if you're an African American you should get tested, but it is one of the high risk factors, along, obviously, as the case with many cancers, genetic. You know, if your father had prostate cancer, my sons, hopefully, who are in their mid-30s, will understand that their father had prostate cancer, and therefore they enter a slightly higher risk group. But the caller, Will, is absolutely correct about African Americans.
Thanks a lot, Will. We'll go to Joe now in Prairie du Chien. Joe, hi.
Hi. In 2001, my father and I were both diagnosed with prostate cancer within about a month of each other.
Wow.
I was 47, he was 75, and we both chose to have him taken out. In retrospect, Dad probably shouldn't have. The chemo and radiation just tore him up and, I think, accelerated his demise. But it helped me immensely because I think of just my age and the longevity factor involved. And one aside, we had numerous PSA tests leading up to surgery. One of them came back, I wasn't pregnant. So,
well, congratulations.
Yes, I wanted to be on Oprah, but no, thank you. So, but I think there's a difference in the age. Mm. I think that's the biggest factor involved in this.
Joe, sorry about your dad. Glad about the outcome of your prostate cancer. Jack, again, different treatment at different ages.
Very important what he said. Very important what he said, because the recommendation now, and I totally understand that. In fact, the first caller, Wayne, apparently had this treatment when he was 70. The older you get, for the number two reasons. Number one was what Joe said, and that is you do not come out of treatment as well when you're older. And part of the reason I decided to get surgery now was I was only, when I got the surgery, 62. I was in good shape. So the worse you react to radiation and surgery when you get older. And number two is, if you're 75 years old, 78 years old, and you get prostate cancer, according to the level that you get now, you will probably die before you die of prostate cancer. I mean, statistically, I would not have been dead of prostate cancer when I was, let's say, 75, because I got it when I was 62. But I might have been dead of prostate cancer when I'm 82. I mean, none of this is pure science. It's a little bit of guesswork. But the older you get, the more you have to really consider whether or not you are going to get surgery, intervention, radiology, or radiologically or surgically. And that's something to talk over with your doctor. When you get above the age of 70, 75, you're talking seriously that you should think of the consequences of intervention.
Jack, thank you so much for sharing your experiences with us. I appreciate it.
Okay, thanks for having me.
That was Jack McCallum. He's a sports writer, he's a journalist, and his book is The Prostate Monologues, What Every Man Can Learn from My Humbling, Confusing, and Sometimes Comical Battle with Prostate Cancer.
Coming up, our guest talks about her experiences caring for her mother, who was suffering from Alzheimer's, and the gifts that she got along the way. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.